reason I'll get 99% is this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, as promised last week, we're going to talk about Brexit. Seems to be becoming the number one issue of concern in the global economy. Everybody in an investment world is currently focusing on it. Could be a big issue. Could be. May not be. All right, why might it be? Well, you know, first of all, global financial asset markets have produced massive amounts of returns here for wealthy investors. The new global finance capital elite that I talk about in my book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, that's driving all these global bubbles and instability. This group has made tremendous amount of returns, money, profit, from financial speculation everywhere in the last 7 years, since 2009. And, you know, these investors, once they make a huge amount of money, they look for excuses to cash in, take the money and run. And if you look at what's been happening with stock markets, they've kind of been bubbling up at and can't seem to get above a certain level. That's, you know, true for Europe stock markets, for U.S. Dow and S&P 500. And, of course, the stock markets in China have collapsed back to where they were before their bubble. So there's not much more money to be made in stocks, you see. The bond market, okay, there seems to be a little bit of a bubble growing in government bonds and soon in corporate bonds. So there's some money to be made there, and of course there's a lot of money to be made on currency volatility, since that's as the global economy slows and all these other problems emerge in the global economy, these currencies bounce up and down, and you can play the ups and downs and make money if you're a professional speculator, and that's still here. But they're looking for an excuse, and I think they're focusing on this Brexit, the UK exit from the European Union, as an indicator of a time to grab the money and run. Now, well, if that happens, what we're going to see is a significant correction in global stock markets. But maybe not. Let me explain why not, as well as why possibly. Not much may happen. Yes, contrary to all the big huff and puff about a big crisis coming, that's not necessarily guaranteed that it will happen. Simply because they vote, the British people vote to exit, doesn't mean exit occurs immediately. No. One of the options is that nothing happens. So they have this vote and nothing happens. Because what must occur is Britain must actively withdraw from the European Union. It's part of a treaty. You see, the European Union is a free trade agreement. Yes, free trade, and all the problems of free trade are now bubbling up behind the surface here in this UK Brexit issue. There are three issues really behind Brexit that are driving it. One is the immigration that's part of the European Union. If you're a member of the European Union, you must accept labor migration across without visas and so forth. And where the jobs have been in Western Europe, as the EU has added membership from Eastern Europe, it's resulted in a flood of migrants from Eastern Europe into Western Europe, where Germany and so forth, and France and England. So that has had an impact on the economy, at least on workers in the UK. This massive flood from Eastern Europe. At the same time, Britain has had a policy of its old Commonwealth, British Empire, to accept people, you know, from Pakistan, India, and so forth. So that's been an immigration effect that's been going on for a long time. And now, of course, we have the wars in the Middle East stirred up by the U.S. and agreed to by NATO and therefore the UK and others. And now we have people just leaving those war zones, flooding into Europe, and they do eventually enter the UK, although the UK has prevented a lot of that flow from France. And you have similar disruptions going on in Northern Africa, and that flood comes in to the UK. So you have this massive multi-immigration problem that has an effect on the economy in the UK. Now, businesses like the immigration because it means very, very cheap labor, but it drives down wages and upsets the labor markets, and of course workers have a problem with that. So we have this effect of on the economy of immigration, you see. Behind Brexit is this issue of immigration and the economic effects of immigration. That's one of the issues here. You know, Brexit is kind of a proxy for discontent over the economic effects of immigration and the cultural effects of immigration. When you have too much too fast immigration, as has occurred in Britain from all these multiple sources, you know, it has a cultural effect. People feel like the old England is disappearing, and it is, of course. And for those over 40, that's a problem, especially for those over 60. You know, the old English way of life is rapidly changing. They look around, and not everybody is pale lily white, and they have some problems with that, different cultural norms, etc. So there's a cultural issue here behind Brexit, not just an economic issue, but a cultural issue. And then there's a sovereignty issue. Again, as I said, the EU is a free trade agreement, and in free trade agreements and treaties, countries give up their national sovereignty. In other words, one of the hallmarks of a free trade agreement is if a country agrees to a free trade agreement, then it cannot pass domestic laws that in any way contradict that free trade agreement. In other words, your elected representatives cannot act as your elected representatives because your business folks, with the help of your executive branch, which is pretty much you know, bought lock, stock, and barrel by the business interests, they negotiate. In other words, they legislate. When you say you have a negotiation over a free trade treaty, in other words, your non-elected representatives, the business elite and their politicians, have legislated laws called the treaty, and your truly elected representatives can only vote up or down on. You know, that's what NAFTA was about. That's what the TPP was about. So you lose national sovereignty. And it's not just that the laws embodied in the treaty cannot be contradicted by your own legislators. In other words, once the treaty is negotiated and signed, you can't amend it through your national legislature. So there's a loss of sovereignty. And it's not just on the legislative level. There's a loss of sovereignty on the judicial level. These free trade treaties have their own courts. So if there are disputes, and the free trade treaty courts rule on them, your domestic courts and judicial system cannot render decisions that contradict the treaty court decisions. You see, free trade is not just an economic event. Free trade is a reflection of global elites, economic elites who are behind negotiating them, taking control of the political system on a supra, above national level, and creating their own national governments and their own national laws, ultra cross-national laws that contradict sovereignty, popular sovereignty, and democratic rights at a national level. That's what this means. And globalization, a part of globalization, is this integration on a supranational level, above national level, and therefore above democracy and institutions and representation as we know it, enacted by elites who we didn't elect, economic elites who we didn't elect at all, but they're legislating now in these treaties, rules and regulations and benefits for themselves that contradict the national level and national representation. So there's a sovereignty issue here. National sovereignty is being picked apart by free trade agreements, and people are beginning to realize this now, and there's resistance to it. So the opposition to remaining in the European Union by the people in Britain is not just an economic impact, negative economic impact through immigration and other ways. It's not just a cultural impact issue, but it's also a realization that we are losing control over our governments and our representation. We're losing representation rights. So all these things are tied in with this issue here of withdrawal, Brexit, British exit from the EU. And that has to be understood from the very beginning here. So three issues, economic, cultural, and sovereignty, are at play. Now, everywhere, leaders of advanced economies and so forth have been pushing free trade and global integration because it benefits their business interests to put them in office. And when David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister of the UK, ran for office, right, a year ago, a little over a year ago, while he ran even before that, November of 2014, he struck a Faustian bargain, right? You know, Faust, this character, you know, from Goethe's great writing, is about a fellow, professor who strikes a bargain with the devil. He wants to know everything in the world, and the devil says, okay, I'll let you know everything in the world, but I have your soul. When you die, I take your soul, right? And, in other words, you go to hell. Cameron struck a Faustian bargain. He told, as he ran for office, he promised the British people, he says, if elected, if you elect me, I promise to give you the right to vote, a referendum, to withdraw from the European Union. And this referendum will be a simple in and out vote, up or down vote, I promise, right? And that put him over the top. Right? But now the devil wants his Faustian bargain. The devil's demanding its due here, and he has to give it to him. And giving it is this referendum that's going to occur on June 23rd in Britain on whether to stay in and out, in or out of the EU. Now, he thought that this would be an easy play. He thought he could get away with this, because at the time that he ran and made these promises, the polls showed that even though the discontent with the EU and loss of sovereignty and free trade agreements was growing, only 34% or something like that, people wanted out, and out of the EU, right? And almost 60% wanted to stay in the EU. But what has happened since he got elected last May 2015, and that attention has focused more and more on this issue of Britain's involvement, the polls have switched. Yeah, and now, latest polls, I believe, show 46% want to leave the EU, and 43% want to remain. And that is despite this massive scare campaign that's been launched by British economic elites and global elites to keep the UK, keep Britain in the EU. Because if it doesn't, you see, if the UK leaves, it raises the question, well, gee, maybe some of the other countries should leave too. And if it unravels, if the European Union unravels, and there's all kind of pressures now growing to break up the EU and the Eurozone, which is a subset of the EU where they all use the same currency, the euro. I think there's 19 of the 28 or 30 countries are in the EU free trade agreement region, and 19, I think, are using the euro. So there are some countries within the EU that use their own currencies, and some, you know, some use the euro. Well, the problem with the 19 with the euro is even more intense. The problem being that it may break up. You see, and with Britain leaving, it raises a big question. Certainly, movements and advocates, even among the elites in these other countries, will be empowered if Britain leaves to run as well on a program of let's leave the EU or let's leave the Eurozone, the euro currency. So we could have a political devolution here occurring. It could spin out of control, and more and more countries' economies could leave, and that's got the global economy really tense, you see, because global capitalist elites everywhere are trying to integrate and globalize. In other words, integrate. Globalization means integrate their economies more and more, and as you globalize, that reduces working class wages and incomes and jobs significantly. But it, by lowering wages and so forth, it increases profitability at home for those countries that are in these free trade agreements or in these global money agreements. So it benefits capitalists, and it puts a lot of pressure on working classes. So they want to continue this because there's benefits to it, the global economic elites. But in the case of Britain, you know, the combination of concerns about sovereignty, about cultural impact, about economic effects on working classes has combined in a very strong sense, stronger than in most other countries, and has been driving this exit, Brexit vote here. And so what is it that we can expect to occur from this vote here on June 23rd? Who's for it in the UK, and who's for leaving? And leaving is a significant group in the UK, even within Cameron's Conservative Party, that wants to leave. There's at least 65 of his, I think he's got close to about 300 members of Parliament in a bare majority, but he does have a majority achieved in elections last year. You know, there's a big core, even within the Conservative Party, that wants out. These are people who are concerned about the sovereignty issue and other issues. They have some major spokespersons there. There's Boris Johnson, who was the mayor of London, is extremely popular, far more popular now, according to the polls, than David Cameron is. And he's for Brexit, as are a number of Conservative Party members who have come out for it as well. So there's big splits in the UK party, Conservative Party, over this. Those who want to stay are the British, stay in the Union, European Union, are British banks. The City of London, you see, as they call it, that's the banking sector in London. They're going to lose out if the UK leaves. For one thing, European-based banks, Deutsche Bank and others, are probably going to pull out of London. London's kind of a global center, financial global center, and it's been serving as the primary financial center for the entire EU, with Britain in the EU. And a lot of banks have located, you know, from the continent, have located to the UK. By the way, the UK is battling, City of London is battling with New York and other global financial centers for dominance, having great difficulty. So if Deutsche Bank and some of UBS and some of the other banks leave London, that's going to be a negative. That's going to be a negative for the financial center in London. Also, the banks that remain, Barclays and so forth, and Lloyds, HSBC is more global. They're going to have less opportunity for doing business in the rest of the EU. And, you know, the financial center is really all that Britain has. You know, Britain is just a shadow of its imperial self. It doesn't really produce an awful lot in terms of exports. It's one of the poorest exporting economies in Europe, and it relies on a lot of money inflows, including hot money, from the rest of the world into its financial center to keep going, you see. And recently, a lot of Chinese money has come into the country to invest in infrastructure and new power development, and a lot of money has come in from the old British Commonwealth into the City of London and into London itself in what's called Canary Wharf. That's a word for a development along the Thames there of finance and other new businesses. So a lot of money has come in, and that's all, the only thing that's propped up the British economy since the 2011-13 recession, double-dip recession that hit Europe. Britain has come out of it by stimulating its construction, financial, and housing, and commercial property markets. But those have both cooled off now. And there's a question, if Britain is not the entryway to the EU, how much of this money flows from elsewhere around the world is going to really come into London? You know, as a door into Europe, financial door into Europe. So the banks, are pretty much, British banks pretty much committed to stay in the EU. And of course, Cameron and the Conservative Party, their number one client are finance capitalists, because there's not much else in Britain of any real economic consequences. All right. Some other businesses that export to the EU are also concerned. For the minimal amount of exports, Britain runs a bad trade deficit. In other words, it imports much more than it exports. But the exports it does have, 47% go into the EU. So those British companies that are dependent on exports to the EU, they're going to be hurt. And they don't want to leave the EU, right? Because if they leave, then the free trade, quote, with the rest of the EU goes away, and tariffs go up, and they have to pay tariffs to export into the EU again. Their prices go up, and their exports become less competitive, right? So that faction wants to stay in. Labor Party officials have come out in favor of staying in. That's a reflection throughout the European continent here of old social democratic parties throwing in with the new neoliberal capitalists who are running the show in exchange, hopefully, for a few crumbs. But, that's true. Look at Holland, Hollande in France, quote, Socialist Party, totally doing the bidding of capital to squeeze the workers. Social Democratic Party in Germany is his junior partner in that neoliberal government. So the old social democracy is dead in Europe, and they've allied themselves with the ruling business elites, and of course they therefore are for staying in the EU, right? Germany, the economic elites do a lot of business with Britain, financial and otherwise. Therefore, Britain staying in the EU. The U.S. has come out in favor of Britain staying in the EU, because if it doesn't, the consequences are going to put a lot of pressure on the U.S. economy that's weakening already. We'll talk about that shortly. Right. But who's for withdrawal? As I said, a lot of Eurosceptics in the UK, Boris Johnson and others, right? Those who are opposed to the supremacy clause in the treaty, the EU treaty, that pretty much negates a lot of domestic democratic sovereignty in the UK, as I mentioned. Businesses that are not dependent on exports to the EU, rest of the EU, smaller businesses and so forth, most of the working classes and others in the UK are against it, and others want to pull out and so forth. And the polls, are showing, as we said, this definite shift for withdrawal. And as that happens, all these other pro interests, from pan-national groups like IMF and OECD and World Bank and the U.S. and national politicians are all raising the ante, threatening and trying to scare people about the consequences of any exit. George Osborne, for example, who is the equivalent of the Treasury Secretary in the U.S. in the British government there, has recently come out and said, if we leave the EU, it's going to mean a decline in our economy and jobs and taxes, and I'm going to have to raise taxes 30%, and we're going to have to raise the cost of participation in the national health insurance system, you're all going to have to pay a lot more, right, trying to scare the hell out of everybody and get them to vote, right, to stay in. They're pulling out all the plugs in that regard, all the plugs. What are the conditions for staying in that Cameron has raised? Cameron struck this Faustian bargain, as I said, and said that we should threaten to leave, and we'll put it to a vote with this referendum on June 23rd, and that will put pressure on the rest of the EU to give us a special deal to modify the treaty, the EU Free Trade Treaty, to satisfy our concerns. And we'll have a special arrangement, right? That's what he said. And I will negotiate these changes once I'm elected in office, and we will get a better deal from the EU, a special deal only for us, but we will get a better deal. We will reform the European Union to our benefit here. Well, what is it that Cameron proposed in terms of these reforms? Well, addressing the immigration issue, Cameron has raised from the very beginning over the past year with the EU that he wants a four-year waiting period during which immigrants from the rest of the EU into the UK, right, would not get benefits, including those who were employed in Britain. Would not get any benefits, social benefits, and so forth. And there's a lot of Eastern Europeans who have come to Britain, particularly Poland and other places, to work. They would get no access to benefits, including the National Health Service, right? Even if they're working, and there's millions of them. All right, a four-year wait period, in other words, and there would be additionally limits. On immigrants from the other EU states, time limits. In other words, you could only send so much, only so many would be able to enter the UK from the new states. They didn't want, as the European Union added new members to it, you know, particularly in Eastern Europe, Baltics, and so forth, you know, with all the jobs in Western Europe and Britain, you know, people were just leaving in en masse from Eastern Europe to the West. And as I said, that was on top of the immigration flow from Syria in the Middle East, and on top of this Commonwealth flow. So the immigration issue, you know, was even more intense in the UK than in other places in Europe. So you know, he made that a centerpiece. You know, we're not going to allow them to come in. Well, part of the treaty is this thing called the Schengen Law, which says if you're in the EU, people can move anywhere, right? And to require that change on immigration flows means that the treaty has to be changed. Well, to change a treaty, everybody's has to agree to it in the treaty. So 30 different countries have to agree to it. And do you think Eastern European countries that are have this advantage of some of their population going to Britain and sending money back, you know, repatriating money, which is good for their economy, and the fact they've left is good for their economy. They don't have to find jobs for these people. So it's a big benefit for Eastern Europe, for Poland and other countries. Do you think they're going to vote to change the treaty? No. No. It's not going to happen. But Britain and Cameron want a treaty change, right? And particularly, they want to change some of the laws, the judicial court laws, that have given the EU free trade courts preference over their own domestic courts and so forth. So these are changes that are very, very difficult, if not impossible, for the European Union to initiate, you know, full treaty renegotiation changes to change these laws about free movement of labor, right? And also, Cameron has wants the right for national legislatures to veto EU rules and regulations. National legislator in legislation in this case would be the British Parliament, right? Well, you know, if one country can overturn and negate one law, well, other countries can do the same for that and other laws, right? So it would mean a dissolution of the free trade agreement. In other words, Britain would be able to keep the benefits of the free trade agreement, access for its products into Europe, but could essentially block anybody else sending their products into the UK if they wanted to, see. And part of Cameron's demands were also legal assurances that those countries that had the euro as their currency wouldn't take advantage in trade with countries in the EU, like Britain, that kept their own currency, the pound, right? So these were the reforms that he's demanding, and these reforms are really not deliverable. Right? You know, for the EU to agree to these would mean to pretty much mean the beginning of the end of the European agreement. Hmm? There's an interesting parallel here that I got to talk about, and that is Cameron's attempt to reform the rest of Europe, the EU, very similar in some ways to Greece's attempts over the years here, three times, including most recently last year, to, quote, reform Europe, to force changes in European neoliberalism and its, you know, its free trade arrangements and its central bank arrangements and its limits on fiscal spending arrangements, etc., to simply negotiate a change in that. You know, one of the problems of the Syriza government, that's the party that runs the Greek government since last year, you know, they tried to reform Europe. They knew that they could not get a relief on their massive debt level imposed on them by Germany and the rest without actually reforming Europe itself. And they thought that they could do that. They would get enough support of progressive elements throughout Europe that they would be able then to force changes in European neoliberalism and get some debt relief. Well, that proved impossible. And they failed. By the way, I have a book coming out in July called Looting Greece, The Emerging New Financial Imperialism, that I'll be talking about and writing about on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Folks may be interested in that because the arrangement, the domination by Northern Europe and the Eurozone through their currency of Greece and some of these other peripheral economies, southern periphery in the Eurozone, is an example of a new form of imperialism that's taking form here that we're going to see more of in the near future. We're already seeing something like that emerge in the U.S. with regard to Puerto Rico. But in any event, you know, there's similarities here. Cameron wants to change. He wants Europe to, quote, reform. Right, British voters want EU reform, but they don't. Hopefully, according to Cameron, they want exit. Right, so they want reform, but they want exit. Well, the Greeks, right, also had Greek voters, right, wanted to stay in the Eurozone, but they don't want the reforms. You see, they don't want the austerity reforms that the Troika of European Commission, ECB, European Central Bank, and IMF have imposed on them, right? So they don't want the reforms, and the British voters want the reforms, but the Greeks don't want to exit, but the Britons may want to exit. It's an interesting contrast, isn't it? But it's reflective of these pressures in Europe against this greater integration within Europe, whether it's the EU Free Trade Treaty or the Eurozone Central Bank Currency Treaty, whatever. You know, all these attempts at capitalist integration across countries really wreak havoc with people's incomes if you're not a business person, right? Causes a real, you know, decline in your wage incomes in various ways. Austerity is one of the consequences of all this. So people are now, in Europe in particular, beginning to resist this integration, this centralization negotiated by capitalist elites, mostly bankers, right, to provide this concentration, centralization of and new institutions, which people don't elect, you see, new institutions that are running the show. Well, this is part of neoliberalism, this creation of pan, in other words, across country, new institutions that aren't subjected to accountability by democratic means, right, that they can then run and control and impose changes and de facto legislation and court decisions on the rest of the people, right? This is capitalism outgrowing national institutions and national democratic representation forms. You see, it's moving faster than the political institutions, the old institutions can adapt. Capital, as it globalizes and moves and so forth globally, it has to have new institutions. And, you know, the World Trade Organization and these free trade treaties and the European Commission and so forth, these are all reflections of this growing integration, concentration. But it's causing real problems with the rest of the folks, rest of us, in terms of our living standards, our incomes, and our democratic rights and sovereignty. We saw this in the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement just negotiated, right? That free trade treaty and those deals, the U.S. cannot pass laws, the U.S. Congress, that contradict it. And the same with NAFTA. EU is just another NAFTA. Right? And now they're trying to expand it. So there's resistance to this going on everywhere, and it's a reflection of that. And in the UK, we have a concentration of problems here that have exacerbated this more. And then the nationalist interest, you know, Britain has never really felt that a lot of them, that they're part of Europe. They think they're exceptional, special, right? That nationalist predilection has also affected this vote. But if if Britain leaves Europe, it could have a contagion effect, just as if Greece exited the Eurozone, it would have a contagion effect. So there's some interesting parallels here, I would just think, between Greece leaving the Eurozone and the UK leaving the European Union. You know, one very, very small and significant economic country and one very, very large relative country like an economy like the UK. But it's reflective. Both are reflective of this resistance growing to this new institutions and capitalist integration and globalization going on, because it has real, actual negative effects on people. And we're going to see more of this occurring, right? Okay, so what are the consequences here? What happens if there is a Brexit and the polls are leaning towards a Brexit? Well, if you listen to you know, all the spokespersons for global capitalism, tragedy, crisis, you know, terrible, terrible, terrible things are going to happen, trying to scare people, right? But as I said at the beginning, nothing may happen. Just because they vote doesn't mean Britain leaves the EU. It just means that the people have said, we want you to leave the EU. Well, then the capitalist Cameron and the others will continue maneuvering in other ways not to leave. See, there is, if you are a member of the EU, there's what's called Article 50. And Article 50 of the treaty provides for a two-year interim period in which the parties can discuss, negotiate, whatever they want, the terms of exit or negotiate staying in or whatever. After 2 years, there can be an automatic renewal. Right. So what I think is going to happen if there is a Brexit vote here is that Cameron and those, will just move on to another plane in maneuvering against the popular will to keep Britain in some way still engaged, still part of the single market, as they say, of the European Union. Right? There will be intensive negotiations, which will go on for some time. Now, if the negotiations go on too long, it will have negative impact on the British economy because a lot of uncertainty. You see, investment and capitalists don't like uncertainty. They want to know one way or another what the future looks like. And if they don't know, they just freeze up. They don't do anything. They don't spend more. They don't increase production and so forth. Some of them will pull back and be, even more cautious, right? So there'll be a two-year negotiation period here, most likely, between the parties. It doesn't mean there's going to be an exit. But that uncertainty already has an effect, you see. It has an effect in the UK on stock markets and on bond prices and on currency. The pound, the British currency, is already declining. Stock markets are declining, right? Government bond rates, sovereign government bond rates, are approaching negative. You see, interest rates, government rates throughout the Eurozone, the continent, already negative. This is part of $10 trillion in government bonds globally that are in negative territory, which has a very negative effect on banking and lending and therefore on the economy, which is another topic. We'll talk about negative rates next week in general. Already bond rates are dropping significantly in the UK. They're about 1%. They're negative in Germany and elsewhere. 10-year bond rates are 1% in the UK. Bond rates in the US are declining. They're about, the 10-year rate is a little over 1%. When bond rates drop, bond prices accelerate. So we have a bond bubble growing, certainly sovereign bonds globally here, and now in corporate bonds as well. Well, that's a speculative bubble, you see. That's the kind of stuff I talk about in my book, Systemic Fragility. These bubbles keep popping up and rotating globally, and now we got a bond bubble going on. So, you know, when you say what happens for Brexit, you got to say, well, what happens for the UK, both economically and politically? What happens for the EU, the European Union, economically and politically? And what happens for the rest of the world, the U.S.? There's three ways of looking at the consequences of a Brexit. Okay, let's just continue talking about the UK. As I said, stock markets, wavering, the currency is declining, and yields and rates on bonds are declining as well. Well, when you have all of these things happening, money flows into the UK will slow and dry up, right? And the UK, as I said, is dependent on money flows. It doesn't, you know, investment. Money flows mean investors, global investors, sending the money into the City of London, the banks, International Financial Center. When currencies are declining like this, and bond rates are declining, and stock markets are declining, there's going to be less flows in. And Britain has been extremely dependent on these flows to finance its infrastructure development and housing boom that occurred after 2013. All right, so both that boom and infrastructure have been slowing, and the economy has been slowing. And if these money flows in also decline in volume, then it's going to slow the economy in the UK even more. The IMF recently, just a couple of days ago, issued a report that said the consequences of a Brexit would be somewhere between a 1.5% drop to a 4.5% drop in the UK GDP. So real investment will slow. In other words, already slowing because of the uncertainty, and especially if the negotiations with the EU drag on for two more years, a recession, right? And the Bank of England, of course, has been harping on this as part of the scare tactic, right? And Osborne, the Treasury Secretary, they call it Exchequer over there, has been threatening that, if the economy slows, like the Bank of England says it will, I'm going to have to impose more tax increases, and we're going to have to make people pay more for National Health Service, in other words, more austerity. And you're going to see some of the banks in London move back to Paris and Frankfurt. When it occurs, and let's say, assuming there is a Brexit vote here, right? The UK legislature, the Parliament, still has to vote on exiting the treaty, right? There may not be any vote. In other words, it still has to formally sever the ties with the European Union. It may not do that. Well, all that uncertainty. They can't have it both ways. In other words, vote to leave the European Union and yet not leave the European Union. They can't have it both ways. And the European Union, European Commission, and others are saying just that. You know, you can't do that. We will invoke Article 50. And if necessary, the UK, will be violating the treaty, and therefore we will invoke Article 7 for nation states that violate the treaty. You know, if that happens, then it's going to get messy, and the messier it gets, the more negative economic impact it's going to have, you know, on the EU and on the UK. Now, the UK currency declining, right? When stocks declining and government bond rates declining, will all drive down the pound, the currency, and that will, I predict, have the effect of dragging down other currencies, particularly the euro and the Japanese yen. The European Central Bank will then accelerate its bond buying program, driving interest rates even further into negative territory in the European Union, right? Denmark and Switzerland, you know, which have currencies that aren't the euro, you're going to see a flood of money into their currencies, and they're going to have to raise their interest rates to slow down that fund flow even more. That's going to slow down their economies even more. So, in other words, what happens is you get more currency volatility, and you, and as a consequence, you're going to get a slowdown of the real economies. Currency volatility will spill over from Britain and the UK into other European countries, as I said, but also globally. If the EU, European Central Bank, pumps a lot more money into the economy and the consequence of Brexit, it already is pumping in a lot, well, then Japan is going to have to accelerate its monetary injections, its QE program. And Japan's been sitting out there just watching and waiting to see what happens with interest rates in the U.S. If interest rates in the U.S. rise, it doesn't have to drive down its currency further into negative territory, negative rates, and therefore its currency declining. It doesn't have to do that. And if Europe, if there is not a Brexit vote, then the ECB won't accelerate its money injections, and therefore Japan won't have to. But if there is an exit, Brexit, what you will see is a decline of the euro and a lot more ECB money being injected into the European economy. And you will see the U.S. not raising its rates as Japan had hoped and other countries had hoped. We're already seeing that, right? The whole, if there's a Brexit, there won't be an increase in U.S. rates this year. As it stands now, maybe only one will occur, but Brexit, there probably won't be any if it occurs in the U.S. Because if the U.S. raises its interest rates while the others, while Britain and Europe are reducing theirs and Japan is reducing their currency and the euro is declining and the yen is declining, if the U.S. raises interest rates, it's just going to make U.S. countries, companies, multinationals, even more uncompetitive, reduce their profits globally, and slow down the U.S. economy even more. So the Fed, our central bank, is not going to do that. See, the U.S. will stay on hold if there's a Brexit because the European Central Bank will depress its currency, or its currency will already fall. It will then add more liquidity, and it will fall further. And Japan, who has been sitting on the sidelines, has to do this as well because its currency, the yen, is already rising faster. And it's been thinking about pumping even more money into the economy because when they do that, it lowers interest rates. Lowers interest rates makes currency more and your goods more competitive, right? So globally, Japan will respond. We'll have an intensification of currency wars again going on. We will have dueling central bank QE money injections, negative rate competition. And the U.S. will hold off from rate increases even further. You'll have a lot of money flowing out of Europe and the U.K. and Japan into the U.S., driving up bond prices, this bubble we already have going. Right? And all that will put pressure on China's currency, the yuan, to devalue even further. You know, we almost had a big crisis here last August where China devalued within a certain band limit, caused a lot of reverberations and concern globally. And China has kept it within that limit, but its currency has been pushing against that limit. So it will have to devalue. If it devalues, when all these other currencies are being driven down, set off by this Brexit situation, well, then global oil prices will decline even more. And we're already seeing that. This little recovery that occurred in global oil prices has already dissipated. And now global oil and commodity prices are sinking once again. Well, if there's a Brexit, actually it's sinking in anticipation of a Brexit. And if there is a Brexit, then you'll see global oil prices decline, and certain countries dependent on oil prices are going to be in even worse shape than they are now, from Russia to Venezuela to Nigeria and so forth. Investors everywhere, with the declining rates, negative rates, and declining oil prices and commodity prices, and there could be a very significant 10 to 20% global stock market correction in the event of Brexit. Investors globally, the finance capital elite global, is going to run for safety and put their money in U.S. Treasuries. So this already movement we have in U.S. Treasuries and this bond bubble being created globally by negative rates and falling rates and falling currency volatility and so forth is all going to intensify. Now, those are all possible consequences of this Brexit, even though they're not going to do anything, most likely, should it occur. Yeah, it's kind of amazing, isn't it, right? Okay, so what are, to summarize some of the possible outcomes of a Brexit, which looks like it may happen, I would say it's 55-45% that it will happen. Well, even though there is no move to immediately leave, you know, the UK economy will slow because of the uncertainty. Central banks will continue to drive down bond rates. That was the bond bubble. As the interest rate bond rates decline, go negative, further negative, bond prices will rise. The bond bubble is a price increase going on, right? And that will mean banks will tighten their lending even more than they have been, which means the real economy is going to slow because of bank lending tightening. Okay? Intensification of currency volatility worldwide. Dueling QEs by Japan and Europe are going to resume. Slowing U.S. exports, manufacturing, and recovery. And investment freeze globally, meaning more decline in labor productivity and therefore wages and jobs. Okay, those are all the consequences. Next week we will talk specifically about negative interest rates. What do they mean?